You know, more than 11% of U.S. households rent self-storage space to hold the things we can't bear to part with but can't fit in our actual homes. And yet we keep acquiring.
I know seems to describe a state of affairs which guarantees what is known, guarantees it as a fact. One always forgets the expression, I thought I knew. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that's a great encapsulation or illustration of our individual and general attitudes toward knowledge, because we're so proud of knowing. And I kind of picture knowledge as an island. And after that, the implication is that there's the abyss. And his quote hints at what's really, really important about uncertainty, and that is its mutability. Knowledge has this dynamism that we are very loath to admit to. I like to think of uncertainty as wisdom in motion and not the paralysis that we think it is.
There's a divide in the theory of evolution between those who see the world as driven primarily by contingent events and convergent events. So the number one contingent event, very easy to understand, is the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, right? If that space rock had been delayed by 5 seconds, it would have missed the Earth probably, and dinosaurs wouldn't have gotten wiped out, and humans probably wouldn't exist, right? Our entire existence is predicated on that fluke. Now, a convergent event is where small changes basically get ironed out because certain things work and other things don't, and so nature sort of solves the problem. And so I think about this with human society as something I've coined this term of the snooze button effect, where it's like, you know, you hit the snooze button, and does your life change? And if it doesn't, then that's a convergent pathway. You're going to end up in the same place anyway. If it does change, then it's a contingent event. And the mind-boggling thing is that we'll never know which of those events are most diverting our trajectories, because it's plausible that hitting the snooze button changes all the people you meet that day and has unforeseen ripple effects potentially for the rest of your life.
Like many people, I had this idea that it was just something to eradicate, that uncertainty is just something to get beyond and shut it down as fast as possible. It's really simple. We fear and dislike uncertainty because as creatures, you know, for survival's sakes, we need and want answers. We have to solve, you know, what to eat, what to do, etc. And so we evolved to have a stress response when you meet something new or unexpected or murky or ambiguous, and your body and brain kind of spring into action so that when it's your first day on the new job, or you're meeting your in-laws for the first time, or all those sorts of lovely life situations, you know, your heart might beat or your palms might sweat. But at the same time, and this is newly discovered, neuroscientists are beginning to unpack what happens in the brain. The uncertainty of the moment, the realization that you don't know, that you've reached the limits of your knowledge, instigate a number of neural changes, like your focus broadens and your brain becomes more receptive to new data and your working memory is bolstered. So this kind of rings a bell. You're on your toes. And that's why uncertainty at that moment is a kind of wakefulness. In fact, Joseph Cable of the University of Pennsylvania said to me, that's the moment when your brain is telling itself there's something to be learned here. So by squandering that opportunity or retreating from that discomfort, we're actually losing an opportunity to learn, because your old knowledge is no longer sufficient. You need to be wakeful, but you're also able to take up that invitation.
Shakuhachi made it in Osaka. Play it to the strangers.
The more updated idea of what learning is, that it entails surprise. I mean, no surprise, no learning is what the neuroscientist Stanislaus Dehaene told me and writes about. So when we are jolted from our daily routine, i.e. when we are recognizing the limits of our knowledge, when we're uncertain, that's the time when your body begins to, and your brain begin to turn on, so to speak. What's really also important to note about this is that what I'm describing seems like a kind of unconscious response and what can you do about it, etc. But actually, there is a conscious approach to uncertainty that we have. It's really important not to retreat from the unsettling nature of uncertainty. We can also lean into uncertainty. And I've tried to find the right word for this, and I can't think of any other than leaning in, because it's sort of a deliberate embrace of that stress and that wakefulness. But it's really important to, again, recognize that this is good stress. And another illustration of how this operates is in the realm of curiosity. Many different studies related to the curious disposition show that one of the most important facets of our curiosity is the ability to tolerate the stress of the unknown. So in other words, to lean in to that uncomfortable feeling and to know that that's your brain's way of signaling to you that this is a great chance to think and to learn and to create. And people who are curious, who have that capacity to push through or to embrace the awkwardness of uncertainty, also are more likely to express dissent, and they're more engaged workers, et cetera, et cetera.
And when we're in a world where 8 billion of us are interacting all the time, we just are so much less in control than we think we are. We control nothing, but we influence everything. And it goes back to that wonderful introduction you had and that Ray Bradbury story. Everything we do is important. It affects the future. But we're not in control of anything in the present. And I think that, to me, is actually quite an uplifting and liberating way of seeing the world, because we don't always have to pretend we're in charge of the way the world unfolds.
We each have our personal comfort zone in relation to uncertainty. Our impression is that uncertainty is static and that is synonymous with paralysis, etc. To be uncertain also has that ring of passivity. But when you are taking up that invitation to learn that the good stress of uncertainty offers you, there is a bit of a slowing down that occurs to action and to snap judgment and to racing to an answer. So in contrast to what we expect so often, uncertainty involves process. And that's really, really important. And so, you know, we can take one example of experts. You know, today we really venerate the swaggering kind of expert who knows what to do and whose know-how is developed over, quote unquote, so-called 10,000 hours. That type of expertise needs updating. That type of expert's knowledge basically tends to fall short in new, unpredictable, ambiguous problems, the kind that involve or demand uncertainty. So years of experience are actually only weakly correlated with skill and accuracy in medicine and finance, et cetera. People who are typical so-called routine experts fall into something called carryover mode, where they're constantly applying their old knowledge, the old heuristic shortcut solutions, into new situations, and that's when they begin to fail. Adaptive experts actually explore a problem. They spend more time on a problem than a novice even. And so there's this motion here, this forwardness, I think. I think of uncertainty as honesty, because that's involved with wakefulness, but I also think of it as dynamic, very, very dynamic.
But when the night is falling, you cannot find the light, you feel your dreams are dying, hold tight, you got the music in you. We'll be right back.
And it's really important to note that uncertainty is not ignorance. Ignorance is blank slate, the blank slate. I might not know anything about particle physics. I am ignorant. But when I'm uncertain, it could be this way, it could be that way, I'm not sure, I'm again reaching the limits of my knowledge. And that's the chance where we can push beyond those boundaries.
Oh,
I mean, at some point, you have to decide and act, right? But maybe the mistake here is assuming that one needs to be certain in order to act.
Yes, well, you have to be relatively sure, or the road does fork, you know, metaphorically and literally, and you usually have to take one. And you're right, forward motion involves choices, involves decisions, and involves solutions. And uncertainty is never the end goal. Uncertainty is a vehicle and an approach to life. But I also think another really important point is that most of the time, and again, I just kept coming up with this reiteration in my research again and again in different forms, but most of the time, it's our fear of uncertainty that leads to paralysis. It's not the uncertainty itself. If we approach uncertainty knowing it's a space of possibilities, or as another psychologist told me, an opportunity for movement, then we, roll up our sleeves and be present in the moment and start investigating and exploring. But if we are afraid of uncertainty, and if you are intolerant of uncertainty, you are more likely to treat uncertainty as a threat. The very, very simplest definition of intolerance versus tolerance of uncertainty is treating being unsure or something surprising as a threat versus a challenge. And one of the classic signs that you fall on the extreme of the spectrum is that you think surprises, et cetera, are unfair. And of course, we all do at certain points. I mean, we all do think that the traffic jam is unfair. But maybe if you can think of it as a challenge or reframe it, which actually there were studies during the pandemic, people who were intolerant of uncertainty were more likely to use coping strategies based on denial, avoidance, and substance abuse. And of course, hey, we all did some of that too. But people who are tolerant of uncertainty were more likely to use problem-solving focused strategies such as reframing the situation.
Will you ever be kind enough to yourself to say that I have done my best?
Well, probably not, because I think another thing that I've always feared is sort of contentment and complacency.
It's not complacent to acknowledge that you've done your best.
Well, if you've done your best, what are you going to do next? You've got to do something better, and therefore you can't be complacent by having done your best. So I think it's always best to make sure that you never score 10.
Basically, more and more psychologists and clinicians are beginning to see fear of the unknown as the transdiagnostic route, or at least vulnerability factor, to many, many mental challenges, conditions such as, everything from PTSD to anxiety. But by narrowing down treatments to just trying to help people bolster practicing not knowing, basically, boost their practice with tolerance of uncertainty, they're actually beginning to find that that might be a really important way to shift even intractable anxiety. So there's been one gold standard peer-reviewed study by probably one of the world's greatest experts on anxiety, Michel Dugas. And he found that people who were taught simple strategies to basically try on uncertainty, their intractable anxiety went down. They also worried just about as much as most people, which probably is still a lot these days. It also helped their depression. And then other studies with multiple different kind of populations show that these kind of very laser-sharp focused strategies about uncertainty actually boost at least self-reported resilience in patients with multiple sclerosis who are dealing with a lot of medical uncertainty.
Yeah, that statement you mentioned earlier that we influence everything but control nothing. If I think hard enough about that, it gives me almost the same physiological effect I get from like going to the top of a tall building and peering over the edge, like knowing I'm not going to fall, but finding it, terrifying. Is there a reason why knowing that we can influence things but control nothing leaves us feeling so, upset?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few reasons for that. I mean, one of them is just that modern life in the West especially, right? I mean, like the ethos of modern life is to optimize for efficiency in everything we do and to basically acquire more and more of the world. And so I think some of the culture we're steeped in tells us we have to control things, right? I mean, you see this in the phenomenon of modern life where, you know, adults will like live stream minor inconveniences as though there's some victim of some enormous, you know, catastrophe and so on. And it's just because, you know, we want to feel that sense of control. There's also an evolutionary explanation, which is that, you know, it's adaptive for us. In other words, it helps us survive to be able to navigate a world that we fully understand. I mean, in the distant past, cause and effect relationships were pretty straightforward. You know, you hear a rustling of grass and you run away because it might be a saber-toothed tiger. You try to understand modern economics with 8 billion people in the economy. None of us can do that. I mean, our best economists can't do that. Our best computers can't do that. So, you know, we have this disorienting feeling of having these brains that have evolved for a sense of sort of gravitating towards straightforward patterns and also wanting to control them. And yet, you know, we live in a world that is fundamentally uncontrollable. And I think it's better for us to acknowledge that than to live within myths in which we sort of continually get disappointed because we pretend that we can control a fundamentally uncontrollable world.
This point in time, in this era, when the uncertainty, that is what humans cannot know, seems to be rising, at this moment, the worst possible response we can have is to retreat into certainty and familiarity and obviousness. That curtails our creativity and our ability to solve the precisely complex problems that are at our doorstep, the lethal problems at our doorstep. And so by doing precisely the wrong thing, the thing that we don't want to do, the uncomfortable thing, by flipping our worldview to make uncertainty at least something to admire, to explore, to embrace, that's the way we can move forward at this time in our world history.
The mark of a good teacher is someone who can elicit from the class a question that they themselves cannot answer. And that's when you know people are engaged, because they're asking why.
I think the fear of the unknown has kept me from living the life I truly want to live. And the way it often manifests is in this instinct to stick to the refuge of routine, or this impulse to constantly imagine all the ways something might go badly, which really in the end just becomes a justification for not trying anything new. And it's strange that intellectually I'm very comfortable with ambiguity, but in my actual life, I often behave as though I'm terrified of it.
What's the number of this day? What's the number of this day? Please check, approve, and file away. Stairs.
so be sure you don't throw that away.
Really interesting about interventions to help people bolster their tolerance of uncertainty is that it harnesses uncertainty's power and strength. It's not that it's a jolly good thing to be uncertain all the time. It's just that it lends itself to peeking into the complexity of the world, the complexity that's already there.
There is this belief that some people hold that if someone's a billionaire, they must be a genius, right? And there's a fascinating study I cite in Fluke, which is, it's basically a collaboration between some physicists and some economists. And they construct this very crude, basic, fake world. But they have a few key assumptions that do match the real world. So they have a sort of distribution of talent. And it's a normal distribution, which means there's sort of a big number of people in the middle, a bell curve in the middle. Most people lie around the average. Right. And then there's a small number of people who are really, really talented and a small number of people who are really not talented. And they say, OK, now what happens in terms of wealth if we introduce luck into this world? And if we think about luck striking like light, then if you actually think about that and how it's going to operate in that system, the lightning strikes are almost certainly going to hit people in the middle because there's so many of them clustered around that average. And when you think about wealth as a byproduct of both, you know, talent, hard work, but also certainly luck, what you're actually seeing in their model, and this is what they found, was that the people who became richest in that fake society were almost always around average level talent. Basically never was somebody on the top end. And I think what we do is we have this sort of thing called the narrative fallacy, where we sort of work backwards. So we say, oh, they're rich, therefore they must be talented. And in fact, what this shows is that actually, no, very often people who end up on top are people who got struck by the luck lightning.
I grew up expecting that stability and predictability was just an entitlement, that this is the way we should live, that this is the skill set you need to adapt in order to thrive, et cetera, et cetera. So we basically have sort of airbrushed out of our psyches in many, many ways the ability to live in precarious situations.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because you know, if you come from a place of precarity, or if you exist in that space, comfort with uncertainty may not be a luxury you can afford. If you don't feel safe, for good reasons, uncertainty takes on a different hue. And that's something that's definitely worth acknowledging.
Yes.
It's also really bad when we do the same backwards logic to explain why terrible things happen to people. They may just happen randomly.
I struggled with writing this because there's a difference between the way the world works and the way that it may be comforting in a moment of personal crisis to imagine the world works, right? And like study after study shows this psychologically that, you know, if we win the lottery, people are relatively comfortable with saying, oh, I got lucky, right? It was just totally random. There was no hidden purpose here. But when you get a cancer diagnosis, or, you know, you lose a loved one, or you get broken up with, you know, we are allergic to the idea that there was no purpose behind it. And, you know, I think my personal beliefs, which are, you know, informed by scientific reasoning and so on, are that, no, I think there are things that just happen. I think, you know, I think it's unfortunate, but I think there are things that happen with no larger guiding purpose behind them. Of course, believers will have totally different viewpoints from me, and I respect that. But there is some interesting stuff about this, about how there's a human instinct that is different for positive news compared to negative news. And we really, really struggle when bad things happen to us to accept randomness or chance as an explanation. But I mean, when you think about it, you know, the people who were on the airplanes on 9/11, for example, I mean, you know, it was just unlucky. They could have booked a different flight. They could have been on a different airline. I mean, a million things could have happened differently. And they got very, very unlucky. And I, you know, somebody was going to end up on that plane. So it's the kind of stuff where, again, I think there's a question between what's a useful, comforting mechanism of imagining how the world works, and then also the conveyance of what I think is more scientific inquiry about what's going on sort of under the scenes, and so on, behind the scenes, as it were.
Shakuhachi made it in Osaka. Play it to the strangers, pass and pray on their phones. Got a dog beside me, she's the best she can be. Likes my shakuhachi and sings all the tunes and sings all the tunes. Come brothers, sisters, show us what we take away. What's your coda gonna say? What's your coda gonna say? Sisters, friends, started nice and early, set out on a journey, took it to the island where time doesn't change. Stuff stays the same. Watch the night tide turning. Scented candles burning.
You know, for hundreds of years, particularly in the West, we've been pursuing what Dewey called the quest for certainty. I see this massive, long crumbling in humanity's, or at least many societies' ability to assume certainty where there was none. And so you can also see many, you know, different studies showing rise in precarity of work hours or rise in, you know, weather patterns, etc. It does seem as though things might be in more flux. And so that is the time when I think we need a sea change in our attitudes toward not knowing in order to face this moment, and not hide in our devices or hide in our certainties.
But when the night is falling, you cannot find the light, light. You feel your dreams are dying. Hold tight. You got the music in you.
Thank you.
T, very, very much is about knowing the limits of your knowledge. So even, for instance, something as simple as a Google search is associated with people thinking they know more than they do, even if they actually didn't find what they were looking for. And that's really important, really important, because if you don't know the limits of your knowledge, you can't push beyond it. You can't know what you don't know, which, of course, is the starting point of all learning.
What's the number of this day? What's the number of this day? Please check, approve, and file away.
On the hopeful note, we maybe need to make more visible the way in which our entire cultures are predicated on certain types of language. You know, for instance, hedge words, words like maybe and sometimes, they're seen as weak linguistically, give people two different signals. One, that you're receptive to another's point of view, and two, that there's more to know out there. So just by throwing in the word maybe, studies show that you don't look weak as you might assume.
What you're just saying about the power of words like maybe, I'm really skeptical of that. And it goes back to the political problems here. You actually talk about this in the book. Do you know what people don't like in leaders? Leaders who are intellectually honest and say things like, I don't know, or I'm not sure. If you want to not get elected, just be intellectually honest in that way and humble in that way and see what happens. We don't like that. We don't like it in ourselves. We certainly don't like it in leaders. And I don't know what to do about that, but it would be better if it were otherwise.
And our over-detection of patterns, that is why we're vulnerable to superstition and also things like conspiracy theory, right? There may not be a reason beyond the reason that appears to us, but we want to find one.
Yeah, this is where it's really fascinating when you look at global patterns of superstition and conspiracism and so on, which, you know, they're resurgent in some place in the West, in the United States and so on. 40% of the world's population believes in witchcraft, which is an astonishing statistic, but it's defined as the supernatural ability of one person to cause harm to another person through supernatural means. So 40% is not a low number. Now, that sounds crazy, right? And I think there's a lot of judgment that comes along with superstition. It's actually quite a rational coping mechanism to deal with uncertainty. I mean, if you don't understand why the world is operating a certain way, why not imagine, you know, a superstitious explanation? It's something that, as I said, you know, with our shortcut brains trying to find patterns, it's better than no explanation for a lot of people. Now, I mean, the conspiracy theories thing, I think this is so fascinating. This is where I draw from the work of Jonathan Gottschall, who wrote this phenomenal book, The Storytelling Animal. And what he says with conspiracy theories, I think it's a really elegant and simple explanation. He says, look, our brains have evolved to tell stories about why things happen. That's the simple cause and effect narratives, the shortcuts I was talking about. Now, when a conspiracy theory comes out, it's one heck of a good story, right? It's got cover-ups, shadowy cabals, really, you know, shadowy characters who are doing nefarious things. And the debunker of the conspiracy theory is saying, no, 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 there's no story. So you have, on the one hand, a great story, and then no story on the other side. Just, oh, it's randomness, or it's like, you know, it's just a very straightforward explanation that's not interesting. And the storytelling animal, which is what Gottschall calls humans, we're just seduced by this, right? So he says it's a losing battle. I mean, you can do all the fact-checking you want, but, you know, we have brains that are very, very compelled by storytelling, particularly exciting stories. And so I think this pattern detection that we have, you know, it's like one of my favorite stats about this in studies is from The Death of Princess Diana. And there's an amazing survey in which a similar number of people who are conspiracy theorists simultaneously believe that A, she is still alive, and B, that she was killed by the government, right? And like, these are logically incompatible ideas. But the reason they do this is because they have something called magnitude bias, where they think it was a big effect, therefore it must have had a big cause. There can't be an accident. It can't just be a car accident, right? So it's easier for them to process an event like that through a story than through what was effectively a freak accident.
Everyone who is alive right now, pretty much everyone who's alive right now, is going to regret the amount of time they spent looking at screens.
Ah.
So that's just, I think, when I get to the end, if I'm lucky enough to be able to pause and reflect, why the hell did I look at my phone every 5 seconds? What did I do? Oh, this is so precious, this whole life, and I've looked at my fucking phone. And I always knew I was going to die. Why did I do that?
So when someone is confronted with that feeling of fear that comes with not knowing, or that anxiety that comes with not knowing, how should they sit with that? I mean, what is your practical advice?
Well, I think first telling oneself that this is, you know, your body and brain's way of signaling that there's a moment when the status quo won't do, that this might be uncomfortable, but that is not a situation or state of mind that is against moving forward, but actually propelling you forward. Because it is discomfort to admit to or to see complexity, nuance, other people's perspectives.
People like to believe that we have common sense, but actually it turns out that common sense is very often not very useful at all, that it is based on all manner sometimes of bias hunches, which are connected to a story but not connected to a reality.